Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
How can an errant protein or minor DNA glitch make you lose your mind? Sarah Manning Peskin joins us to talk about her book, A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of the Hijacked Brain. What makes cooking with a wok so special? Kenji Lopez-Alt will be here to talk about his new book, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Plus, our critics will be here to talk about the books they've been reading and reviewing. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's March 18th. I'm Pamela Paul. Sarah Manning Peskin joins us now from Philadelphia, where she is an assistant professor of clinical neurology at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of her first book. It's called A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of the Hijacked Brain. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned to you before we started recording, but I'll mention for listeners, I read your book and loved it. My 12-year-old son read your book and loved it. One of the things that you did so well in this book was explain science really through stories, and in particular through case histories. The style reminded me a little bit of Lisa Sanders's diagnosis column in the New York Times Magazine, if you're familiar with that, that each one is written kind of like a mystery. And I'm curious what the thinking was behind that.
I think I wanted to capture how this actually unfolds in real time, that for a lot of us, we go to doctors and you get a diagnosis and it's as if that diagnosis has always existed. But in fact, the diagnosis was invented by someone who discovered something. And actually, the history behind these diseases is often lost. And actually, since writing the book, when I see patients in clinic, when I diagnose someone with Alzheimer's disease, I tell them, you know, this is how we figured out what Alzheimer's disease is. This is who it was. This is how it happened. And I think it's more meaningful and actually allows us to understand diseases better.
And you do it not only in telling the biographies of the scientists and the doctors who uncovered these diseases and afflictions, but also of patients. And one of the questions I had was, are these patients actual patients of yours? Some of the case studies in the book, you use the full names. I don't think they're pseudonyms. Were these people that some of them that you've treated?
Only two of them were actually my patients. And when I interviewed them for the books, they weren't under my care anymore. And most of them were people who were referred to me by colleagues. I did change their names, but the other details I've left the same, with the thought that when you read a book where it's sort of compilations, it's hard to know, is that really an accurate picture of what it's like to live with that disease? Or is it stylized in the way that the author thinks it is, or thinks it looks like? And so I wanted to keep the details right so that readers can be sure that what they're seeing is what these diseases really look like.
How is it different writing about people that you'd actually treated from writing, you know, historical case histories in some cases of people who are long since dead?
It totally changed how I see medicine, actually. When we see patients in the hospital or in clinic, you get this small glimpse of what's going on. And even if you have them tell that, you ask them to tell us, what is it like when you move around the world and where do you see difficulty and what brought you here? But seeing someone in their house with their family, learning about what they were like before disease, what they're like after, is just a totally different understanding of the humanity of these conditions. So one of the stories is about a woman who, born into difficult circumstances, had this mother who pushed her to get a good education. She ended up at an elite university, graduated, came home, woke up one morning, and couldn't really create new memories. She kept asking her mom what was for breakfast after they'd already eaten.
Oh, yeah.
And her mom ends up taking her to the hospital, and she becomes acutely psychotic. It turns out she'd been watching The Walking Dead, and she starts to believe that she's living inside the show, and she calls different nurses and family members by names of characters from the show. I met her while she was in the hospital. And I remember thinking her mom was just so impressive and such a wonderful advocate for her while she was there. But for the book, I actually went out to their house after she'd been treated. She actually did wonderfully and was back home doing well. And it was amazing to see what she had been like before the disease, to hear her mom talk about the experience to her, her talk about what it was like to wake up after all of that. And it's just it's a glimpse that we really never get as physicians otherwise.
Well, let's talk about that case. The chapter is called Zombie Apocalypse, and it's the story of Lauren Kane. In her case, her affliction was caused by a protein. Can you explain?
Most of us know proteins as, you know, you go to the grocery store and you buy, you know, Greek yogurt and it has a lot of protein. But proteins are, they're particular molecules. And if you think about your body, DNA is essentially just a computer code that has all the information and the instructions for running the cell and running a body. But it's proteins that really are the workhorses of the cell. And yeah, there are particular proteins that are called antibodies that the body makes to try to get rid of invaders. The antibodies are things that we make that we helps us fend off, you know, viruses and bacteria. But it turns out in this condition that this woman had, her body actually made a antibody that instead of targeting something that's not supposed to be there, it actually targeted her brain. And that's what caused her disease. And when her doctors figured it out and they filtered out the bad antibodies and they gave her medication to make her body stop making antibodies, she actually did beautifully well and she went back to being herself. And that disease was only discovered within the last 2 decades. So if that had happened 30 years ago, she would have been sent to an inpatient psych facility, probably would never have gotten out.
And what is that called, that disease?
So it's called NMDA receptor encephalitis. So it's a long name. The encephalitis part just means that it's a inflammation in the brain. And NMDA receptor that's actually also a protein. Yeah. And it turns out the reason why people have this disease is in many cases, or about 50% of cases, they can develop a tumor on their ovaries. And the tumor cells actually, they have this protein called NMDA receptors. And then the body mistakenly thinks that it's foreign. And so it makes these antibodies to try to get rid of these receptors, but we also have them in the brain. And so we end up attacking our brains.
So one of the surprising things that causes mental illness, or the hijacked brain, as you put it in your subtitle, is proteins, or errant proteins. Another goes under the category of evaders and invaders, as you term it. And some of those are vitamins, which is really surprising. Thiamine and niacin. Can you explain what happens if you don't have enough? Let's start with thiamine and how we figured out that was the culprit.
Most of us, I should say, get plenty of vitamins and don't need to take extra vitamins because we actually now have flour that's fortified with them. But that didn't used to be the case. And so with thiamine deficiency, it goes back to actually a psychiatrist in Russia named Korsakov. And he started noticing that he would see these patients that had a disease where it was called multiple neuritis. They would get really weak and they would eventually pass away. But he noticed they had this really unusual memory problem where they would do what's called confabulations. So they would essentially create memories that never existed. He talks about going to see a patient in the hospital and he would ask the patient, you know, what did you do yesterday? And the patient would give this extended story about having gone on this incredible trip. Whereas Korsakov knows the guy's been sitting in the hospital for weeks. And sometimes people describe it as filling in gaps where your memory's not working quite correctly. And so you try to create a story to try to fill in the places that are missing in a way that feels logical. We don't know if that's actually how it works. But in any case, the main thing about it is people are, we call them what's called honest liars. So they don't know that they're doing it. It's not purposeful lying. They just sort of come up with these memories of things that never happened. And Korsakov actually dies before he figures out what was causing it. But it turns out it's, in many cases, although not all, it could be caused by a deficiency in thiamine, which is vitamin B1. And then the niacin story is quite remarkable. So it used to be in the early 1900s in the southeastern U.S., there was this huge epidemic of a disease called pellagra. And it caused this fairly disfiguring rash. It caused people to have an upset stomach, and it caused a dementia. And nobody knew what was causing the disease. There was this idea going around that it was caused by flies that would transmit it from one person to another. And the disease tended to affect people who were impoverished. And so the concept of it being transmitted by flies was easy to stomach for people because they could say, well, you know, it's poor people's own lack of sanitation. But the disease gets worse and worse. And then the Surgeon General calls on this guy, Joseph Goldberger. And Goldberger had been born at the foot of the Carpathian Mountains, came to the U.S. at age 9, speaking almost no English, and works his way up to becoming a public health officer. And he'd gone all around the country and even outside the country solving diseases. He contracted typhoid and typhus and yellow fever along the way. So he's really in the trenches. And the Surgeon General says, you know, Goldberger, could you take on pellagra? And very quickly, Goldberger figures out that it's not actually an issue of sanitation. It's actually a deficient diet. And it's not that these poor people are so unclean that they're bringing disease on themselves. It's actually that the country is starving them, essentially. And it is such a more difficult concept for people to accept. And he just works tirelessly, even to the point of trying to expose himself to a supposed infection and proving that he doesn't get it.
Okay, you have to talk about some of the things that he does because it's so appalling.
It's so graphic. There's actually a great book about him that starts off with this, exactly this moment. So he essentially took samples of body fluids from people with pellagra. So he took a sample of their blood and then injected it into his own shoulder. He scraped off some of the flakes from their rashes, mixed it with stool and urine, and then would ingest the pills. He actually had colleagues who volunteered because they believed in him so much, and they volunteered to participate in the research studies too. And his wife even tried to participate, although he limited her participation and only let her get an injection of blood. In the end, he sort of has this very funny line in his paper that says, considering the amount of filth that we took in, we didn't do half badly, and none of us got pellagra, none of us got the disease.
So that disease is basically gone now?
So that disease is gone because eventually they figured out it was actually caused by a deficiency in vitamin B3. And that's now in flour and lots of other things that we eat regularly. And so essentially, it still exists in some parts of the world in places where they don't have fortified ingredients or where there's essentially starvation. But for the most part, it's mostly gone.
Another disease in your book that also no longer exists is kuru. Tell us about kuru and how it ended up infecting so many members of a small tribe in Papua New Guinea.
So kuru was this wild disease that came to be known in the 1950s. There was this guy, Vincent Zegas, who was a public health officer. He had been born in Estonia, went to Australia, gets sent to Papua New Guinea, starts working there for a few years, and then meets this colleague who says, you know, hey, if you go to the highlands of Papua New Guinea, you'll see there's this disease that's killing women and children. And so Zegas, he's the physician in the area, feels like he should know about it, ends up getting invited to go into the highlands and go trekking. And he starts witnessing this condition and he sees these women who they essentially can't stand up. So they go to stand and they're so imbalanced that they fall down. And the same with children. And they lose their language and they start laughing sort of uncontrollably in at situations that are not funny. And they pass away within about a year. And the disease becomes so common that people in the tribe actually were having trouble finding wives. Usually in Papua New Guinea, it was that the men would get killed in warfare and there was a surplus of women. This was the opposite because so many women were getting killed and they couldn't figure out what was going on. Eventually, Zegas starts a bit of a research project and starts dissecting brains of people who've passed away from the disease. And he makes slides and he sends one set off to the NIH in the US. He sends actually another set off to become an exhibit in London. And with the help of some colleagues, he actually figures out that these are related to two other diseases that we now know about in animals and another disease in humans. Eventually, what they realize is that the disease is caused by actually a protein. And it turns out that these proteins are, normally they have to be folded in a really specific way in a really complex 3D structure. And they can misfold in a way that makes them toxic. And the misfolded proteins then cause all the other proteins to misfold also. So that's how it spreads. And so kuru, the way that it was spreading in this tribe in Papua New Guinea, was that the tribe actually practiced cannibalism. And so after people died, they would take different parts of the body and different people would eat different parts. And it tended to be actually that the women, as part of the funerary practice, would tend to eat the brain. And that's how they were getting infected. And they would bring leftovers home for their children. And that's how the children were getting infected. And once that was figured out, cannibalism was outlawed and Ed Kuru essentially doesn't exist anymore.
One of the overall takeaways that you come away with from reading this book is that a lot of mental illness, what we think of as madness, as your subtitle says, and craziness, is just as much physical as it is mental or psychological, if that makes sense. or we're coming to understand that. Is that accurate?
I think more and more we're moving in that direction. I think just of a, you know, a patient I saw recently where the patient had a condition where it caused him to have a essential complete overhaul in his personality. He'd been this warm, kind, loving husband. And now he started berating his wife. He became extraordinarily religious, where he hadn't been religious at all before. He had become obsessed with selling a product that he thought was going to make them millions of dollars. And his wife had thought this whole time that either she was doing something wrong, or maybe he was having an affair, or maybe, you know, he just wasn't interested in her. And she came to our clinic. It turned out actually his disease was caused by a mutation in his DNA that caused him to have this complete change in personality. And it was just sort of a shocking adjustment for her to realize that all this time she thought her marriage was disintegrating because marriages end, people change, and actually it was caused by a single molecule.
I want to go back to the phrase in your subtitle, hijacked brain. How is that different from just any other mental illness? Is it that it's temporary or curable, or that there's a very clear physical cause?
I think when I was using the word, my sense was sort of to aim at the fact that there is a real definite molecular cause. And so it's a sense of you are essentially no longer in control of your own thoughts and your own cognitive processes because of these particular molecules. So it was sort of to try to convey this idea of these are people who lost control of their own mind because of these culprit molecules that we now know about.
Are we discovering new versions of this, new variations of this all the time?
We are. So, yeah, that condition that we talked about that caused that woman to think that she was living in The Walking Dead, that was the first of its kind, the first disease of its kind to be discovered and described. We now know of more than 10 conditions that are similar, that cause different symptoms, that they're caused by a different antibody, but we didn't even know they existed, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And we're now diagnosing them in patients all the time. And these diseases have they've sort of come to this gray area where we're discovering them so quickly, but the information isn't disseminated as quickly as you might think. So if you get one of these conditions and you happen to be in a place where there's an expert or someone knows to look, then you could get treated and you can get better. If you happen to end up in a place where, you know, news hasn't hit, they don't have the tools to diagnose it, you may never get treated.
What do you think is the most interesting research that's taking place right now in this area, in these molecular causes of mental illness?
The biggest problem I think that most people think about is Alzheimer's disease. And that's sort of where we've made some of the biggest advances, and yet we still haven't cracked it. When we think of Alzheimer's disease, what it really is under a microscope, buildup of two proteins, amyloid and tau. For so many years, we actually could not diagnose it until someone died. And so we would have to tell people, you know, I think you have Alzheimer's disease, but I can't prove it to you until you die from it, which is a horrible thing to have to say to someone. And actually now we have the tools so in living people to actually pick up when they have buildup of amyloid and tau proteins. So we can see someone in clinic and we can actually say, hey, we can detect these molecules in you while you're still alive, which has been a huge breakthrough because for so long, part of the reason why we've struggled to cure Alzheimer's disease is because we had no idea who really had it. In living people. And so we would enroll people in drug trials when about 80% of them had the disease, but about 20% turned out not even to have Alzheimer's disease. So how can you know if a drug works if you're testing it on people that don't have the condition? Now that we can actually diagnose the condition at a molecular level in living people, it's just opened up huge doors for drug trials for Alzheimer's disease. And I think that's probably been one of the biggest developments that will affect the largest number of people.
Well, in the book, you really give a sense of how far we've already come with this science. It's completely fascinating. The book, again, is called A Molecule Away from Madness, Tales of the Hijacked Brain by Sarah Manning Peskin. Sarah, thank you so much again for being here.
Thank you so much. This is such a neat thing for me.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? it's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time.
Kenji Lopez-Ault joins us from Seattle. His new book is called The Walk, Recipes and Techniques. Kenji, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You are the first cookbook author I have had on this show.
It's so flattering.
I saw this book, and this is a really, I'm just going to start off right here. It's just a really beautiful book. It's a beautifully designed book. And I'm curious if you, as an author, get involved at all in what the book is going to look like, what the photographs and layout are going to be like, the look and feel of a cookbook.
You know, so this book was meant to be sort of reflective of the first book, The Food Lab. So the sort of all capital typeface and everything we drew from there. I mean, the idea was that we wanted them to look good next to each other on a shelf. So it's the same dimensions as The Food Lab with the opposite color scheme, with the black color scheme as opposed to white. As far as the design and layout and everything, I don't really have much to do with the layout other than sort of final approval and all that stuff. But, you know, I do work relatively closely with the designers at Norton. And the photographs I took myself, with the exception of a couple where my four-year-old was on the shutter. if you see my hands in the photo, that's my four-year-old behind the camera on a tripod. And I tell her, okay, push the button now. And she pushes the
shutter. Did she get a photo credit?
I think I mentioned her in the acknowledgments. And then the, you know, the cover design, that little illustration, that was something I kind of doodled first, and then handed my doodle to a real designer who made it look good.
I was going to say, it's a very nice doodle. Since you brought up the Food Lab, that's probably what people who are familiar with you and your work associate with you most. But for those of us who don't know what the Food Lab is, explain, what is that?
Well, the Food Lab started as a column online on Serious Eats. It was a food science column. You know, I'm not a food scientist with a, you know, capital S scientist, but I write about science and technique behind cooking, particularly behind home cooking. So the goal, you know, the goal with the Food Lab is always to make it practical to home cooks. So it started as a column on Serious Eats in 2009. And then eventually I developed that into a book that was released in 2015. So it's a large cookbook. You know, the recipes in it are mainly in sort of the American repertoire, American and sort of America adjacent repertoire. So things that are familiar to home cooks, but really it's, you know, about maybe a third of the book is recipes and the rest of the book is all talking about techniques and basic principles of food science. You know, so some very basic sort of thermodynamics and chemistry and physics and all these things that I think help you become a more agile cook, you know, kind of things where once you understand them, they allow you to improvise more in the kitchen and sort of stray away from the recipes more.
So you said that you're not a scientist, but you went to MIT. You come from an illustrious family of scientists. How did you get into science-based cooking?
So yes, there are a lot of scientists in my family. Science was sort of just part of the language at home growing up, because, you know, my grandparents lived with us also, or one floor below us in an apartment building. And so science was just sort of a basic part of our language in the household growing up, and something I was always interested in. I started as a biology major. I actually finished with a degree in architecture and switched halfway through. But cooking, I fell into it sort of accidentally in the middle of college. I got my first restaurant job the summer after my sophomore year, when I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And it was a summer job that ended up becoming a career. And, you know, as far as the science element goes, you know, I was cooking for a number of years in restaurants. And, you know, all through that time, I had a lot of questions about, you know, for me, it's just sort of natural to ask, why do we do something? Why is this doing working the way it does? And in restaurants, just by the sort of the nature of how a restaurant works and the goal of a restaurant, which is, you know, more speed and consistency, you don't have a lot of time to really focus on thinking about those types of questions or experimenting with them. And so I had this kind of backlog of questions built up in my head that eventually I started to get to explore first when I was working at Cooks Illustrated as a recipe developer and editor, and then eventually in my own kitchen at home for when I started writing the Food Lab column for Serious Eats. So yeah, the marriage of science and X is something that I feel like was always destined to happen in whatever I chose to do as a career path. And it just happened to be food. I feel like I was in the right place at the right time to be able to write about these things and to build a career out of the type of stuff I write about, because, you know, I was right there sort of right at the dawn of the food internet and the food blogosphere and now sort of food video, and all these things seem to really easily work with the type of content I produce. This sort of, you know, intersection of cooking and nerd renaissance that happened, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. I got very lucky to be able to do what I do now. So one of the other questions I had was, you know, as a cook, I was the new guy at one of the restaurants I worked at for a while. And as the new guy, it was my responsibility to cook breakfast. You know, we about once a week or so, the entire restaurant would get rented out for breakfast parties. And so I boiled a lot of eggs early on in my career. And my sort of strategy back then, you know, and this was the type of restaurant where all the eggs had to look perfect, you know, so my strategy back then was to boil about 40% more than I was going to need, knowing that when I was peeling them, some of them were going to end up cracked and, you know, with shells that were difficult to peel off. And so I've always wondered what makes an eggshell stick. What's the best way to cook an egg so that the shell peels off cleanly? That was a question that I actually tried to answer in my very first Food Lab column. And then also in my first New York Times column, I revisited that. By that point in my career, I had my own restaurant. And so I was able to use it to host a double blind experiment where we got 100 people to come in and each one of them peel a dozen eggs, cooked in various methods, and then see what factors really went into making the eggs faster to peel, and then also peel with the least sort of defects in the surface of the white.
All right, this is actually another really important question that I would like to have answered now. What are you supposed to do?
So of all the variables we tested, and I tested everything from, you know, age is one that people say matters a lot. And I tested eggs that were 60 days old versus like literally fresh out of the chicken that morning. It didn't actually make much difference. The pH of the water didn't make much difference. Shocking with ice didn't really make much difference. The only thing that really mattered was the temperature of the water when you add the eggs to it. So if you start the eggs in cold water, which is the method I used to use, if you start the eggs in cold water and bring them up to a boil and then shut it off, which I think is a very common way people do it, the eggs shells tend to fuse to the whites a lot more, as opposed to if you have a big pot of boiling water or a steamer full of hot steam and you lower the eggs into that, then they peel much faster, much more easily. It goes from, like, I can't remember what the exact numbers were in the testing we did, but it was something like around a 70% success rate if you start with cold water up to like a 93% success rate.
All right, let us get to the wok, because you skipped the wok in your first book. How did that happen? Why did you leave the wok out?
I actually didn't. My first book used to be much longer. It was actually originally going to be a 2-volume set. And in the introduction of the first book, there's a 2-page spread about woks and how the wok is the most versatile pan in my kitchen and how it's my favorite tool and how it has been my favorite tool for years. And there was going to be an entire chapter on wok cooking, but we ended up cutting that chapter along with a few others in the interest of length, because the book is already, you know, as it is, it's like 950 pages long. And so I think originally it was around 1600 pages. So we cut out quite a bit of material. And when we cut out that wok chapter, we forgot to cut out the 2-page spread at the beginning explaining how great woks are. So it's this funny thing, because in the book, you know, in the book, it says woks are great. And then there's nothing else about it in the rest of the book.
So it's just a teaser for this book.
Exactly. So when I started writing that second volume, you know, I was rewriting and reworking a lot of material I already had that got cut from the first one. And so I was working on the wok chapter, and it was up to, you know, a couple hundred pages. And I had barely sort of started talking about stir frying, you know, the most basic technique. And there's still all this, you know, there's still braising and simmering and steaming and frying and pan frying and deep frying and noodles and all these different things that I wanted to talk about that you can do in a wok. And so, I called my editor and I said, Melanie, why don't we just make this entire book about the walk. Let's just write a walk book. Like, forget about Food Lab 2 for now. Let's just do a walk book. And she loved the idea. And so that's what we did. And it was actually a fun and relatively, you know, it took a lot of time, of course, but it was a relatively painless book to write because I'm so familiar with my own walk and the ways that it's useful to me.
I want to stay with stir fries for a second because that's a real misnomer, right? You're not supposed to stir a stir fry. What are you supposed to do?
It's more of a toss fry than a stir fry. And, you know, this is the point that I think Grace Young also makes in her books, that the sort of Western concept of having a pot on the stove, keeping the pot relatively stationary, and then stirring it around with a spoon, that's what stirring is, you know, whereas in a wok, when you're stir frying, in fact, you know, most of the time, if you're very skilled at it, you don't even need a second tool at all. You can just hold the wok and toss it. And in fact, you know, some dishes, like for example, Cantonese style beef chow fun, dry fried beef chow fun, that's a dish where some chefs will even go so far as to say you cannot use a tool to cook it because you're going to break up the noodles. You're going to crack the noodles with the spatula. And so, yeah, when you're stir frying, it's really much more of a tossing motion where you kind of toss everything, it flies back to the back side of the wok, slides out the back, and then rolls back over sort of through this hot column of air and then tumbles back into the wok. And that process is actually very important to stir frying because in the same way that when you stick your hand out of a moving car, your hand cools down very quickly because of the wind blowing against it. Or in the same way that, say, a convection oven will heat things faster than a still air oven. When you throw things through the air and when you have moving air surrounding them, temperature changes and evaporation take place faster. So that process of stir frying, where you really want to drive off surface moisture as quick as possible so that your food is not sort of stewing in its own juices, that tossing motion is really essential to that because it makes the food cook faster and it also encourages faster evaporation.
What does a wok do that other pans don't do? I mean, what makes it so special?
Well, there's a few things, and it really depends on what cooking method you're talking about. But obviously, the first one is the shape and the way that it's heated. So a Western skillet has a wide, flat surface, and your goal with those is to heat it relatively evenly so that there's no real hot spots. So the entire surface is heated to the same temperature. And sort of the materials and both the way they sit on a burner reflect that. Whereas with a wok, typically you're looking for a wide range of temperatures. So you want like a really, really hot zone at the bottom and then progressively cooler zones as you move up to the sides, which gives you instant control over how fast your food is cooking. When you're talking about a stir fry, it's conducive to stir frying because that's what allows you to do this sort of that motion where you're flipping a large volume, you know, like a half pound of food or a pound of food up into the air all at once, which is very difficult to do in a Western skillet and be able to catch it. And so Western skillets are more designed for searing or slow sauteing, things like that. Whereas a wok is much more designed to rapidly drive off moisture and to very evenly and quickly cook a number of foods that are, you know, cut to relatively the same size. There are other properties of a wok as well. Most woks these days that people use are going to be made of either carbon steel or cast iron. I generally recommend using a carbon steel wok. And that material itself, both carbon steel and cast iron, once they become seasoned, and it's a slightly different sense of the word seasoning than when you think about, you know, a Western style cast iron skillet. When you season it, you're building up layer after layer of these polymers by heating oil in it. And so it ends up with a relatively thick nonstick layer that makes it so that the food doesn't actually even come in direct contact with the metal. In a wok, you're not really building up that many layers like that. What you're really looking for is a single layer of black oxide, which is what you get when iron is heated exposed to oxygen. So with a wok, you're sort of seasoning each time you do it, but that black coating actually has a direct effect on the flavor of the food coming out of the wok as well. So if you cook side by side and say a stainless steel shiny wok versus a well-seasoned carbon steel wok, the carbon steel wok has a lot more of what they call that wok flavor, the kind of smoky flavor that you get out of a really good stir fry or certain types of good stir fries. So that part of that comes from the material of the pan itself.
You mentioned wok hay, and I'm going to spell that as hay, H-E-I, not H-E-Y. Breath of the wok, what is that?
So it really depends on who you ask. Some people take a sort of very sort of metaphysical approach to it, where it's, you know, the wok hay is really something that you're trying to capture that comes just from eating in restaurants. It's not something you would really capture at home. And I hear this response more from people who are familiar with Chinese food in China and are familiar sort of with Chinese home cooking versus restaurant cooking. So, you know, in those descriptions, wok hei is sort of the sizzle of a very high heat restaurant burner, the plume of smoke that comes out when they're stir frying, and this sort of particular taste that's highly seasoned that you get out of restaurant food as opposed to home cooking, which is a sort of gentler style of wok cooking. You know, for me personally, wok hei, as someone who grew up in the West and was really only familiar with Chinese food in the context of restaurants, and, you know, particularly growing up in the 80s in New York, that was mostly sort of Southern Chinese influenced Chinese American and Chinese restaurants, so Cantonese, Hong Kong style cuisine, where there actually is a lot of this sort of wok. That's where the concept of wok hei comes from. In Northern China, it's not that familiar, for example. But for me, it was always what my dad would describe as that good smoky flavor. You know, I remember going to restaurants, we would look for good beef chow fun, and my dad would always say like, oh, this place does it really well. It has that nice smoky flavor. And we didn't know what the word wok hei was back then, but we could identify when a cook was really good at it. And so, you know, for me, and I think for a lot of people, that sort of smoky, intense flavor that you get from a really high heat stir fry, that you get when the flame actually sort of jumps into the pan and directly sets things on fire inside the wok, like that's the flavor of wok hei that I associate with the term, that smokiness.
What else do non-wok users not understand about the wok? What do people do wrong? What are the biggest misconceptions?
So the biggest misconception, I would say it's probably the same one that I had for many years. And this is something that I think is unique to Western users of woks. And it goes back to the idea that, you know, my familiarity with wok cooking, and in particular with Chinese cooking, comes mainly from Southern Chinese restaurants in the U.S. or Chinese American restaurants in the U.S. You know, a little bit of home cooking, but for me, there was a little bit of home cooking because my mom was Japanese and they used woks in Japan as well. But that was Japanese cooking, different from Chinese food. And so I think when a lot of people think of woks, they think of these intense high heat stir fries, and they think, I can't cook properly in a wok unless I have this 150,000 BTU restaurant style burner, which I believe for a long time as well, but if you stop and think just for, you know, a little bit about it, that's a pretty absurd thing to think, because, you know, there are literally, you know, hundreds of millions of people cooking in woks every day that don't all work at restaurants. You know, they all cook at home, and, you know, a Chinese range might be a little bit different from a Western range, but it's not going to be this, you know, this giant flaming behemoth that you have at a Chinese restaurant. And so the idea that you can only cook with gas and that you can only cook if you have a very high heat restaurant burner, that's, I think, you know, complete nonsense. And I think that actually holds back a lot of people from understanding the versatility of a pan like this. So, you know, part of it is sort of resetting your expectations of what types of food you should be cooking in a wok, or you can be cooking in a wok. And then, of course, the other part is sort of the technique and understanding the basics of how you cook in a wok, because it's pretty, if you're familiar mainly with Western techniques, you know, where, like searing and sauteing, stir frying and braising in a wok, for example, are quite different from their Western counterparts. So, you know, I'm hoping that this book does a good job of illustrating the types of foods you can make in a wok and the techniques you need to get there.
There's a lot more technique in the book than actual recipes, as you explain, and it's incredibly practical and useful. But just for fun, leave us with not a recipe, but what is your favorite thing to cook in a wok?
That would be Japanese style mapo tofu, mabo tofu. So mapo tofu is a dish originally from Sichuan province in China. It was brought to Japan, introduced to Japan in the 70s, which is where my grandparents and my mom learned it. And so growing up for me, Japanese style mapo tofu that my mom made was always my favorite dish growing up. It differs from the Sichuan. So the Sichuan version is sort of famously ma la, so it's numbing and hot from the flavor of Sichuan peppercorns and chilies. And it has usually has like a very sort of thick layer of this dark, dark red chili oil that sort of floats on top of it. And so, you know, there's a recipe for that in the book, but the Japanese version is much more sort of savory and sweet and hot. It doesn't have any Sichuan peppercorn, so it's not numbing at all. And the chili level, the heat level is relatively mild. So it's my favorite sort of comfort food from growing up. And it's also probably the dish that I've made the most in my life outside of restaurants, at least. It's the home cooked dish I've made most in my life, especially now because I have kids and my daughter loves it. And it's a dish that takes about 10 minutes start to finish. And it's one of those things where it's like, if I don't know what else to serve my daughter that day, I always have the ingredients for Japanese mapo tofu. And I know that she's always going to eat it. So it's just become sort of a staple dish in my house now as well.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with that. I have not yet cooked from this book, but I have read this book. And it is completely fascinating. So I am looking forward to the actual eating part. Kenji, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is the author of The Food Lab, and his new book is called The Wok: Recipes and Techniques.
I'm joined now by two of the Times' staff critics, Alexandra Jacobs and Jennifer Sly, to talk about the books they've recently been reviewing.
Hello, John.
Hi, John.
Alexandra, you reviewed a memoir this week by someone whose memoir I would want to read, and you made me want to read it even more. Who was it, and what's the book?
It is the memoir of Harvey Fierstein, who is the consummate New York theater showbiz personality. He's dabbled in Hollywood a bit. He's best known, perhaps, for Torch Song Trilogy.
On stage.
Yes, on stage, which was made into a movie, but it was an absolutely seismic event in New York theater in the 1980s.
And if no one knows his name or can not bring him to mind, he also has one of the, if not the most distinctive voices in, I don't know if any of us want to do the imitation, but...
I don't want to do it.
But you will if you have to.
I will.
As he writes in the memoir, he has it's like an extra set of vocal cords or something, but he also wore out his voice screaming in some early avant-garde production that, anyway, there's no one like Harvey Fierstein, and there's nothing like this memoir. It's absolutely one of a kind. I just love it. You know, it's full of these incredible one-liners, way too many to trot out here, but my favorite one is a kind of Nora Ephron-esque one he has in the beginning, which is, "Time heals nothing." You know, he's so funny, but it's a dark humor, which is my kind of humor too. And there's something for everyone in this book.
And what are the dark parts? I mean, I assume he obviously was in New York during the height of the AIDS crisis. And
yeah, I mean, I think just growing up, he writes of dressing up as a girl when he was young. He had these various illnesses. He stood out. He was different. And so he suffered the way that all children who are different or don't quite fit in stand out. And then he had dyslexia, you know, which is what sent him to plays, because the text is sparer, you know, it was easier for him to read, and skips two grades in high school and gets into the avant-garde theater, and very early on is in a Warhol production. Oh, even before that, in high school, he's always running into celebrities, even when he's young. Anis Nin visits his English class and he reads her tarot cards. So, you know, it's like that kind of, exactly, it's a kind of literary showbiz zealot.
It's early in the year, but I'm not sure there will be a better detail in a review this year than him reading Nin's tarot, or did she read his tarot cards?
He read her tarot cards, which is, I feel, very Harvey. You know, he sees the moment. He's a scene stealer. He's a scenery chewer and a scene stealer, yes.
It's as far removed from my high school experience as I can possibly imagine. Jen, you reviewed not just one book this week. You looked at a new book, but through a wider lens. The book is Kathy O'Neill's The Shame Machine, which is sort of an ominous title. Tell us what she means by that, and also what you use this book to think about and write about.
By the title, she's talking about those mechanisms that basically fuel and feed off shame, which is a very common emotion. I think it's something that people have been thinking a lot about and talking a lot about, especially within the last several years, especially in the context of social media, which is something she does touch on. But she's also looking at, for instance, advertising, the weight loss industry, the wellness industry, things that make people feel like they're inadequate, essentially, that they should feel ashamed of a certain part of themselves in order for these industries to make a profit. And so I use this book as an occasion to talk about shame in general, because it's something that I've been thinking about. Also, there was a really interesting essay that Vivian Gornick, the critic Vivian Gornick, published in Harper's a few months ago, which was about humiliation, the most extreme forms of shame. It was really one of those essays that just sort of explore humiliation in different forms. She brings her own personal experience into it. She talks about literature, how it's been such a rich subject for novelists. So that got me thinking about the way that shame has been used, both in terms of trying to essentially regulate and maintain social hierarchies and social order, and how it's also been abused, how it's been made to make people feel bad, how it can be such a crushing experience, which I think is something that Gornick really gets into, that it can actually be extremely damaging. She calls it at some point, it's almost soul killing. And so I looked at various books. There was this one fascinating book by Peter Stearns, who's a historian of emotion, which I think is just such a great title. And, you know, he looks at shame through history. He looks at it cross-culturally in different cultures. He looks at the way that shame has or has not been distinguished from other things like embarrassment or guilt in different languages. I also looked at more contemporary books like John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is a book that I think when it came out 6 or 7 years ago, it was a bestseller. I mean, people were ready for a book like this, which really delved into the world of public shaming. And his argument was that, you know, in the world of digital media, on social media, where a lot of people congregate, there's an opportunity to be shamed by strangers and in front of strangers for things that might have, in a previous era, just happened and gone largely unnoticed.
And then there's this interesting flip side, which is shamelessness. You talk about how that's entered our political stream a bit more vividly in the last few years.
You know, it's interesting to think about the Trump presidency, and one of the things that he was called was shameless. And that was a word that was used, I think, both pejoratively, but also for some of his supporters, there was something really that they thought was liberating in this, that he was saying and doing all these things that the mainstream might have looked down on, but that in previous eras might have been more acceptable. It's interesting to read O'Neill's book because her argument is that just like there's good kinds of shame and bad kinds of shame, she's saying there's good kinds of shamelessness and bad kinds of shamelessness. And so when she's talking about shame, there's the punching down shame. She brings her own personal experience of growing up. Since she was a kid, she struggled with her weight. And so she was made to feel shame. And so she's saying that there's like a real liberation and freedom in being able to say, no, 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 I'm not going to be shamed for this anymore. I'm taking control of this. This is who I am. I'm not going to listen to whatever voices are trying to tell me that I'm not good enough.
It's a tricky thing. I mean, it's a hard thing to not feel when people really want you to, you know?
Well, this is exactly it. And I think that this is why it's a subject that there's just always going to be something in it, because it does have to do not only with ourselves and how we see ourselves, but our relationship to the world around us. And that's why I think it's the kind of feeling that it can fuel itself or feed on itself. I mean, there's that whole notion of a shame spiral, which I think is just really evocative, where it's like you feel shame and then you feel some shame for feeling shame.
You know who shame did not crush? Shame did not crush Harvey Fierstein.
Well, there you go.
Right. I was going to say he probably experienced a lot of it when he was younger and he overcame
Maybe.
It.
Maybe.
I wonder why things like elation can't spiral. Why does shame have to be the spiraling one?
Oh, God, right. Yeah. There's never enough elation, but there's always more shame to spare.
Maybe we should get that historian of emotion on here.
Yeah.
The historian of emotion, Stearns, he does talk about, because shame feeds on insecurity. And I mean, what's more bottomless than insecurity? You know, it's like you feel something, but then you question it. You wonder if it's the right feeling. You know, it's just around and around it goes. There's a long history of using shame for the purposes of enforcing social order. You know, it's not really as common anymore, but in the past, people would be put in pillories if they did something wrong.
And the scarlet letter that you mentioned in the essay.
Scarlet letters, dunce caps for students who were misbehaving in class. I mean, there was this idea that because it was so painful, the idea was that it would force somebody to really ruminate and brood over what they had done, that it would be really effective as a form of punishment. But of course, we now look at those punishments differently.
Yeah, its excesses are legion and unfortunate. And yet also you go through life often wishing that some people felt more shame than they do. So it's a complicated subject. I have 25 more questions about it, but I'll let listeners visit your essay online. And thank you for being here to talk about it. Thank you both.
Thank you, John.
This is John Williams, and I am joined by the host of the podcast, Pamela Paul. To turn the tables on her, she has some news. What's going on, Pamela?
Well, as some of our listeners know, not all, the reason I get to host this podcast, which is, I just want to mention, the oldest and longest running podcast at the Times, just turned 16 years old. The reason I get to do this is because of my day job. My actual day job is editing the New York Times Book Review and running the books desk here at the New York Times. And I've been doing that for 9 years. And I'm actually not going to do that anymore. So this is my last time hosting this podcast.
So this has come as a shock to me and to our listeners, because it has been 9 years, which is amazing because I've been here for all of those 9 years. And so, you know, I'm feeling the passage of time as one does. We had occasion to talk a couple of times last year because, like you said, there was a big anniversary last year when it turned 15. And so we talked about this a bit, but I know that when you first started it, there were obviously some nerves because it's a different part of the job that wasn't necessarily what you got into journalism for. How much did you embrace that at first? And how much did you really want to jump in and do it? Or did you ever think about whether you wanted that to be part of the mix?
Well, as you know, Sam Tannenhouse, the original host of this podcast and my former boss, he actually was also here for 9 years as the editor of the Book Review, as was his predecessor, Chip McGrath. So it feels like there's some kind of timer that goes off where you're like, I am done being the editor of the Book Review. In any case, he had been done and it had been announced that I was going to be his successor as the editor of the Book Review. But I didn't really think about the podcast at the time. I'd been on the podcast as a guest and as a reviewer talking about books that I reviewed when I was a freelancer. But I wasn't actually even in my office yet as editor. Sam hadn't left. And he invited me. I remember he was walking down the hall full of cheer and excitement. And he said, hey, you know, come on down to the studio. We're doing the last segment, my last episode of the podcast. Everyone's coming on. You should come on. And I was like, wait a minute. I haven't started my new job yet. If this is your last segment, who's hosting it next week? And he said, you are. And I just was really kind of shocked and terrified, as you mentioned, because I had never hosted a podcast. And I think I really didn't know what I was doing. And it's interesting. Sam said to me towards the end of his time at the New York Times as the editor, he said, you know, my favorite part of the job is the podcast. And I just thought that was insanity. And I have to say, here I am at the end of 9 years as editor of the Book Review. And I can pretty much say the podcast was my favorite part of the job in the end.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that it wasn't in the front of your mind when you were taking over for Sam, because it did sort of seem like his baby at the time. He had been the only host of it. And back then, 9 years ago, there weren't that many podcasts at the Times, were there?
No. I mean, I think that it had gotten down to maybe 3 or 4 podcasts at that moment. Actually, our excellent producer, Pedro Rosado, would know that much better than either of us because he was here working on those podcasts at the Times. But there was a science podcast. There was a thing where someone essentially read the morning news. And there was Popcast, of course, which Pedro also produces. And there was the Book Review. They had just kind of cut back.
Right. There was a kind of contraction. That was sort of a larger cultural phenomenon, that there was this burst of podcasts and there was a contraction and then there was a reburst.
Right. Right. And so 9 years ago was during the contraction when they said, what is this podcast thing that we've started? Let's dial back on that. But they kept the podcast, I think, that had a strong listenership at that time, and they kept us going. So it was kind of unusual. And I think for a long time, I didn't really believe that anyone listened to it. So that took a small amount of the pressure off.
But you found out people listened to it, because we often hear from listeners, which is also a great part of the podcast.
We do. And I have to say, I'm going to miss that. I hope that someone will forward me some of your emails, should anyone email anything after this episode, because getting those emails was really just fantastic. You just like the emails that we would get to books@nytimes.com from our podcast listeners were, all right, I'll just say it. They were my favorite emails. They were my favorite emails. We also get letters to the editor, which I like, and a lot of complaints and customer service questions and all kinds of things go through that email inbox. But the emails from listeners were often really personal, passionate opinionated. Some people would let me know when they did not like a guest or did not like my interview of the guest, did not like the questions I asked. It was funny how people would ask for more about what we're reading, more information, or they would report that they had read something that we talked about and share their feedback. So I really loved that.
Yeah, I love the ones you would forward to me and Greg and others who are on what we're reading saying, you know, a couple of months ago, someone was talking about a book set this place with this kind of character. What was that? And we all kind of had to recreate it. Speaking of what we're reading, that was one of the segments that did not exist for sure during Sam's time. I wonder what else has changed in the podcast. I imagine if we listened to an episode from 9 years ago, it would sound pretty different.
Yeah, what we're reading evolved from a kind of inside the bestsellers that had been done by a number of people. Jenny Schuessler did it for a while, then Greg Coles did it, and we would talk about what was new on the bestseller list. And I thought that the larger idea was, what are people in the world reading? So then it evolved into, what are we in the wider world reading? But we sort of then stopped talking about the wider world or the bestseller list at all and just turned it into a conversation about books. And it kind of became one of the, I keep saying everything was my favorite. I'm just like full of enthusiasm. And people who listen to this podcast know that I'm not always full of enthusiasm about everything. But I loved what we're reading because it was a chance to talk to my colleagues here who I've loved working with and to talk to our critics and other editors on the desk and to try to recreate the kind of conversations that we had when we were in the office. So that also became really nice during the pandemic. The one downside, well, there are a couple downsides. It is really nice to see people in person and to look at human faces when we do that, when we have that conversation. The other downside is that for technical reasons, it can only be a conversation of three. And when we were in the office, it was a round table of four, which sometimes got a little rowdy, but I liked the variety.
Well, and to your point about reader emails or listener emails earlier, it did. It almost made the what the wider world is reading more a part of it, because I think people reacted more to those conversations than they had to the bestseller list with their own thoughts about what they were reading or whether they had read the things that we were talking about. I know that I've gotten some really lovely emails, and I'm sure you've gotten many more about some of the books we've discussed on there and people's memories of them or wanting to know what else we would recommend by that author. So I should say that in this sad period, I think of you as having really long ago actually perfected the hosting of this podcast from the early days when I know that you felt shaky, although that didn't really come across all that much. I feel like you hit the ground running, but you definitely got more comfortable in the role. And I think of you now as a very seasoned interviewer, and I've done some very moving and probing interviews with people. So in the interim, and for a little bit in the future, I'll be hosting the podcast. The podcast isn't going anywhere. And I don't remember really specifically. I know that Sam told you one thing was to really be in the place of the general reader's brain and not to get too far into the weeds, but to let the author describe what their project is and their thoughts about it. And I wonder if you have any advice for me, a terrified interim host.
No, you're going to be great. You already know how to do this, and you've subbed for me on a number of occasions. I remember a very early negative review, I think on iTunes, after I took over, said, "Pamela Paul sounds bummed." And and I never got over that in my head. I thought, I didn't realize I sound bummed. I think it's just abject terror. But I think you're going to be just great. I am looking forward to listening to you. As you know well, and Pedro knows, and everyone in our office knows, I found it hard to listen to the podcast myself because I don't like listening to my own voice. And I would really only listen to it if somebody told me that episode was especially great. I was kind of curious, like, really? Let me listen. But now I'll get to listen to you, and I will be completely unconflicted. So I want to turn the tables now and say, welcome, John, new host of the Book Review Podcast. I think listeners have a lot to look forward to.
Well, that's very kind of you, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate all the times that you have let me host segments over the years as a way to make myself a bit less terrified as this happens. And let's quickly say before you go where people can find you and read you and what you'll be up to, because I know that you have a lot of readers and followers.
Oh, thank you. Well, before that, let me just say also, you are going to be obviously in the excellent hands of our producer, Pedro, and I could not be more grateful to Pedro Rosado. Every week I say to him that he makes me sound much better than I really do in real life, and he knows that that's true, better than anyone. So Pedro will still be here as well. So I'll be moving to opinion, back to writing as an op-ed columnist or an opinion columnist, as it's now called, which is something that I have very sorely missed. I've been doing it on the side. I've written 5 books since I've been at the Times, but I did that, you know, by essentially not living, not sleeping, and not having any fun. So I'm really looking forward to going back to writing full time and during daylight hours and on my paid time and not my free time.
Well, I look forward to reading you there and also maybe to having you on a future episode of the podcast when your next book comes out, since you're so prolific.
All right. Now I can talk about it. Or maybe I'll review a book and you can have me on to talk about that.
That would be great. Thanks, Pamela, for everything.
Thanks, John.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
If your family's like mine, they've got a lot going on. Help them manage with new cognitive health supplements for kids. New lollipops help kids focus on homework or chill out for a sec. Get lollipops at Olly.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.